All rise. Oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060127, William Chu versus Chong Wei Hong from Tarrant County and the Second Court of Appeals District. Docket number 060178, Forest Oil Corporation and Daniel B. Warden versus James Argyle McCallum and others from Hidalgo County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. And 060243, Solar Applications Engineering, Inc. versus TA Operating Corporation from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Green is not sitting in that case. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of the arguments, and the court will take a brief recess between the arguments. We should complete all of them well before noon. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments will be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060127, William Chu versus Chong Wei Hong.
May it please the court. Mr. Cohen will present the argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I am Murray Cohen. Along with my colleague Stephen Barrick, I represent the petitioner William Chu. Also with us today is Mr. Robert Simon of Fort Worth representing the amicus. I must also say that with us today is Marilyn Kretschmer of the state of Iowa, who has nothing to do with this case, except she heard her little brother was arguing a case and wanted to see him in action before the highest court of this state. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals has made three holdings that are not only unprecedented in Texas law, they are contrary to holdings of Texas law, and are three holdings I think this court would never make and should never approve. First, the court created a new tort. It created it not out of whole cloth as a common law tort, but sort of a mixed marriage. It tacked onto the Tufta statutory remedy, not cause of action, but remedy, the tort of aiding and conspiring to aid and abet a fraudulent transfer. That was its first major new unprecedented holding. Three courts have opined that there is no such cause of action. They're all federal courts construing the same statute, Tufta, and those courts are the Fifth Circuit in Mack v. Newton, the Northern District of Texas and FDIC v. White, and the Northern District of Texas in Mullins v. Test America. The second holding the court made, which is unprecedented in Texas law, is that having created that new tort, they created a right to not just return of the property as authorized under the statute, but consequential damages, lost profits. Not satisfied with that, the court went on to make a third major new holding, which is that a person recovering cannot just recover the property and actual damages and consequential damages, but also punitive damages, as the plaintiff did in this case, and the court affirmed it 2-1 over a thoughtful dissent by Justice Gardner.
Can a spouse ever recover against a third party in a divorce proceeding?
No, Your Honor. Under the law of this court, it cannot.
That's contrary to the holding in the Schluter case?
It is contrary to the holding in the Schluter case. I didn't mean to cut you off. It absolutely is. I believe the court cannot affirm at the very least, the alternative causes of action, probably not, and I'll tell you why in just a minute, the Tufta cause of action either, Justice Medina, without overruling Schluter.
Well, Schluter was only as between spouses.
Schluter specifically reserved the third-party question and, in fact, seemed to perhaps condone it because the award stood below
against the father.
father-in-law.
That's right. May I speak to that? I don't think it's right to say that the court reserved, you're right, of course, that it was, did not involve third-party liability, as this case does. But I wouldn't say that it reserved the issue. What it said was, we don't reach the issue because it isn't presented. The father-in-law didn't attack it on that basis. Second of all, this court has reached the issue, albeit not in Schluter, and it reached it and ruled unanimously in 1960 in Coors versus Scott that a third-party conspirator with a husband defrauding a wife of community property was not subject to liability when the primary actor was the husband. Don't let anybody tell you, Justice O'Neill, that fraudulent transfer cases are boring. In Coors v. Scott, Mr. Scott was the elected district attorney of Harris County. He was taking community property to buy automobiles for his mistress. This was no ordinary mistress. She was the owner of a house of ill repute. Later, after he won his election, he had to leave office under that cloud of suspicion. In this case, his wife was suing Mr. Scott, the husband's co-conspirator, Mr. Coors, who bought the Cadillacs and held the notes and dealt with the property secretly used to buy the Cadillacs. What the court held was unanimously is that beyond any question, as between Scott and Coors, that's Mr. Scott, not Mrs. Mr. Scott was the principal actor as to Mrs. Ayers, the mistress, the automobiles, and the fraud. Under the facts before us, the fraud having been initiated by the husband and mainly carried out by the husband, just like in this case, she must look primarily to him and his property to right the wrong, and they held that the trial court settled that by dividing the property in the divorce. So,
well, since mistresses seem to be all over these cases, what about the lottery ticket to the mistress?
Greatest case I've ever seen. That's Mays versus Stewart from the 14th Court of Appeals. I think there's a very important difference in Mays versus Stewart that lets the party recover, lets the wife, the former wife in Mays, recover. And that is that unlike this case, and unlike Coors v. Scott, and unlike a legion of other cases, Ginsburg, for example, from the first court, unlike all those cases where the wife was not permitted to recover, the reason she wasn't permitted to recover was because the theft from the community was known at the time of the divorce, taken into account, and compensated for in an unequal division. In Mays, this lottery ticket worth millions of dollars wasn't known at the time of the divorce. The divorce became final. It obviously was not considered in making any unequal division. In fact, the husband, after the mistress turned on him, he sued the mistress because she wasn't conspiring with him anymore to see that he got the lottery ticket proceeds. He told his former wife what she was doing. She sued them both, and he was indicted and convicted for aggravated perjury. The reason I mention that, Justice O'Neill, is they had to give the wife in Mays v. Stewart relief because she couldn't have gotten it in the divorce. That's what distinguishes that case from this one.
Would it have been different if the community estate had not had the funds to cover that sort of a loss? In other words, if you've got a transfer of a lot of money and you can't get it back, and the estate's not sufficient to make the spouse whole, then can you go against the third party?
I suspect that that is a common problem where there's no money left in the estate to pay for what has been stolen and wasted by the misconducting spouse. That argument of injustice was made powerfully by Justice Heck and Justice Specter in dissenting opinions.
But again, that wasn't a third party. That was as to the spouse, and that dealt with interspousal immunity.
That's right.
A different twist.
That's right. But Coors v. Scott did deal with a third party where the community property, the defrauded community property was taken into account during the divorce.
But give me, other than what's been done in specific cases, what would be a reason why you wouldn't allow, if you've got a third party who's actively aided or abetted a fraud and there's no more property left and the community estate can't compensate, what would be wrong with allowing suit against the third party?
The only reason that Justice Heck could come up with, I believe, in his dissent, of course he was arguing for the side he disagreed with, was enough is enough. We're not going to abrogate interspousal immunity that far. If the court wants to change public policy to permit that sort of new level of liability, it would have to overrule both Coors, both Schluter.
I just don't understand.
To do it.
Well, as to a third party, you wouldn't have to overrule Schluter.
All right.
But what's the public policy argument that would preclude? Because I understand the abolition of interspousal immunity in Schluter didn't deal with it as to a third party, and I can't understand a policy argument. If you've got a wrongdoer, why you shouldn't be able to pursue them differently?
The courts seem to – I have struggled with that. The courts seem to have resolved to treat a marital community comparable to a bankruptcy estate. That's not a very romantic notion. That's not what we usually think we're signing up for when we propose marriage and engage in it. But that's how the courts have looked at it, as a circle within which there are a husband, a wife, and their property, and that the frauds stay within that circle. I think that the possible injustice in a case like that that was identified in the dissenting opinion in Schluter is probably unanswerable, except that the court at that time felt that that was the right way to treat a marital community.
Does the record indicate that Attorney Chu personally benefited in this transaction other than collecting reasonable attorney's fees?
Not at all. And Justice Medina, it does not. It only shows, and I would specifically point out the same pages of the record that my opponent, Mr. Cram, has cited in his brief, which is Volume 5 at 115 to 127 and page 135. It only shows, and that's the only pages he cited, that he knew, Chu knew, that the wife had an interest. Not that he knew that the husband wasn't authorized to deal with that interest. You'll recall the husband signed a statement and notarized that he was. Not that he knew the husband was going to take that money and leave with it for Korea. Doesn't show that.
Would it make a difference if he did know that, or if he did benefit in some for some personal gain?
I believe that might be a factor the court could consider in considering the punitive damage award. I think it might be a factor that the court could consider in weighing the effect of Coors v. Scott. Coors v. Scott, they said, well, the husband was the principal actor. By implication, Coors was a minor actor. You would consider that maybe to say, well, how much was he a minor or a major actor?
Wouldn't that also be a factor in whether he fits the definition of a transferee under Tufta?
No.
Whether he received a portion of the proceeds? No.
I would answer the question no. Let me state a fact in response to that question, Chief Justice Jefferson. First of all, the only benefit he did receive, what, as far as this record shows, was a law fee, which is the same, as far as we know, is the same fee he would have received if this dispute had never arisen. I suppose, and I believe the language you may be referring to in Tufta is that Tufta gives relief against transferees or, and I want to say this very carefully, it doesn't give it against transferees and beneficiaries. It gives it against transferees and the, quote, the person for whom the transaction was made. That is a much more specific limitation than mere beneficiaries. As we pointed out, the bicycle messenger who took the deed to the courthouse was a beneficiary. I suppose I'm a beneficiary. I'm here because of all this transaction representing Mr. Chu. But for it, the nine of you would have only two cases to do today. I don't know if that makes you a beneficiary or are harmed by the transaction, but if that's the kind of – that's why I would argue that's why the statute doesn't say beneficiary. It says the person for whom.
But if Mr. Chu's client was the husband, and the husband comes and says, I want you to claim that this donut shop is mine, separate property, mine alone. The attorney's supposed to say, no, I won't do that because I think.
Let me make sure I understand.
I'm concerned about the attorney's status here. I understand you're for the other side, but let's just, you know, we're talking about what's, you know, between spouses, fraudulent transfers and stuff. What if husband comes to his attorney and says, I want you to claim this donut shop is mine and mine alone?
You're assuming, Justice Brister, that Mr. Chu was representing the husband of the plaintiff in this case?
Right.
Okay.
Or just, you know, what is an attorney supposed to object? Is attorney supposed to say, no, I'm not going to make that argument that it's yours and yours alone because I think it's hers?
In your hypothetical, would the husband be, would Mr. Chu be representing only the husband and not the co-owner wife?
In other words, you're Mr. Chu's even one more step removed, where the people that are involved in the deal are coming, and one of the people says, it's mine and mine alone. Is he supposed to object to that and say, no, I won't take that position?
I don't think he is. Consider, I think in response to that question, the powerful presentation made by the amicus brief is particularly relevant. Consider the problem faced by Mr. Chu. I know that you would have it that he was representing the husband of the sellers, but here he was representing the buyers. This is a transaction that had already tried to close and failed. There'd been a bounce check. There'd been a threat by Mrs. Hong of criminal prosecution for that bounce check, threat back of civil litigation. Then we have the buyers, Chu's client, still saying, let's close this deal. He's writing letters saying, I'm going to sue you if you don't. And then into his office walks Mr. Hong. Realize, unlike Mr. Kors, Chu had no dealings over the years with Mr. Hong.
This is the other side.
He had, Kors had decades of dealings with Mr. Scott. And here they are. And what is his duty to his client? Is it to refuse to close the deal that they've been paying to represent him on, to undertake a duty of investigation? You know, as Mr. Simon said in his amicus brief, this not only imposes unheard-of duties of investigation on parties like attorneys, title companies, accountants, but these duties can't be discharged by any amount of investigation into public records. They don't show who is a contingent possible creditor in the future. And further, those liabilities are uninsurable because, as in this case, they're for intentional torts like conspiracy. So I think it sets up an impossible conflict for an attorney because in that position, he has a seller he doesn't represent walking in, and the question that he must answer, which he can't in your hypothetical, is, who is my client?
Does your position undermine at all the case law on abrogating interspousal immunity for personal injury claims?
I don't think so. I think it has no effect on that. I think this court has drawn a clear line on personal injury claims, treating them that recovery as separate property.
Other questions? Counselor, the court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Cram will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Justice. In this case, the Fraudulent Transfer Act is a statutory tort. It's broad enough to encompass conspiracy liability for Mr. Chu, who made this whole thing happen. The record is very clear.
What did he do besides he drafted the papers?
He made an amendment to the contract after he sent a demand letter to both clients, changing the terms of the contract, reflecting that Q Kim, who we'll call Mr. Hong here, the husband, was the sole owner of the business when he knew he was not, never asked for a power of attorney. And by the way, that's the simple way to resolve the title question here and resolve the attorney's problem. You get a power of attorney from the wife, giving the husband authority to sell the business. Mr. Chu didn't do that. He didn't.
My question is, did he do anything other than draft the papers?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. He drafted the amendment, which he knew was wrong. He went ahead and closed the deal. He backdated the bill of sale to the original date and had his legal assistant act as notary.
But what duty would Mr. Chu owe to your client? Why don't the lawyers that represented your client, why wouldn't they have a duty to look into those alleged misconducts?
Mr. Justice Medina, generally the attorney would have no duty, but when he knows the facts and he knows of my client's interest, he has a duty to make sure that it's done right. Well, he knew what he was doing here.
What about a lawyer who's trying a lawsuit and knows the other side hasn't put some evidence up that he knows about
or she knows about, and you argue to the jury that just didn't happen because they didn't prove it. You know that something, a lawyer knows that somebody on the other side hasn't accomplished something, but to whom, is that going to make a lawyer liable in every instance when a lawyer takes a position that they may have some extra knowledge about?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it. It will. In this case, he knew somebody had an ownership interest, and he did everything in his power to take away that interest without checking.
Could he take away that interest? Did he ever take her interest away?
No, but he...
So he didn't.
Well, obviously, we had to file a lawsuit, and it took 5 years to get to trial, and of course, through the appellate system here, and we're here today still trying to recover that. He facilitated the Kims, the third-party transferees, to do what they did, which was take away this lady's interest.
But everybody in civil litigation is trying to take away somebody else's interest. Everybody, especially in divorces. And everybody in divorces is mad at each other and thinks the other side's cheating and lying. And I'm just wondering if we're going to have anybody willing to represent people in divorces if it creates, after every divorce, a 5-year lawsuit against the other side's lawyer. Not even my lawyer. I haven't paid him a dime. This is the other side's lawyer. And I'm going to sue for 5 years because I didn't get a good deal in my divorce. That, obviously, would be a disaster. Now, separate your case from that.
Well, Your Honor, in that case, both parties are represented by lawyers and have a fair hearing in court.
Divorces, a lot of times, only one side's represented by a lawyer.
But they have an opportunity. In this case, my client wasn't given the opportunity. My client specifically indicated she would not sell, did not want to sell, and didn't know anything about it. The first time she found out that Mr. Chu had done what he had done and closed the deal is when she went to work the next day and was locked out and couldn't get in. And that was her sole source of income for five.
She can sue her ex-husband for that, for a fraud.
Yes.
And she can sue the other side, can't she?
Yes, she can.
So why does she need to sue the other side's lawyer?
Mr. Chu, in this case, facilitated the whole thing. Without him, this would never have occurred.
And all I've heard you say is he drafted the papers. And normally that's, you know, lawyer. The question is, do lawyers have to make sure that everything they're being told when they draft papers is right, or they have to pay for it personally?
I think they have to when they know it's not right. And Mr. Chu admitted that he knew it was not right in trial.
Why did he know it was not right?
He knew that Ms. Hong had an interest.
Why did he know that? Because she said so before.
He also wrote her a letter. He admitted that he knew she had an interest.
Sometimes people, he knew she had claimed an interest. He had treated her as having an interest before, and now the other side is coming to him saying, "I don't have an interest. We don't have anything recorded. There's no deed or anything on record that shows that he could have checked, right?"
Yes, there was, Your Honor. There was a contract between the Kims and the Hongs.
Earlier in the same transaction, two people had said they were owner, and now one's saying they're owner.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he's going to have to decide the lawsuit between them before he decides whether he drafts the paper?
As I said earlier, Your Honor, I believe that the easy way to handle that is to get a power of attorney. That's done every day in the title business. And that's why if a married couple sells a house, whether it's separate property or community property, the spouse has to sign the documentation.
Doesn't that make your client his client? Aren't you trying to make your client his client by making him get a power of attorney to protect your client?
No, Your Honor. Making him get a power of attorney is assuring that the people transferring to his clients have authority to transfer.
Who does he have an obligation to get a power of attorney? His clients or your client?
He has an obligation to assure that his client is getting the proper title.
Wait a minute. My question was, who does he have the obligation to? His client or your client? You're suing him, saying he has an obligation to your client to get a power of attorney. How does that duty arise to your client?
The duty arises, I believe, Judge, because he knew that My client had an interest. He admitted he knew he had an interest, and he didn't do anything about it. He just took this man's word for it and never checked on it.
What if his own client was telling him, I want to close. I don't care about an attorney, the power of attorney.
Well, he can only sell what Mr. Kim, the husband, can only sell what he owned, which was one half, and that's all he could get.
His client's willing to take that risk, saying, I don't care. I don't want a power attorney. I want to close. You're saying, aren't you, the lawyer has to say, sorry, I won't do it.
No, as long as it's disclosed. In this case, he tried to cover it up by changing the contract.
Well, his client's not suing him. Mr. Chu's client's not suing him.
That's correct. And in this case, Your Honor, Mr. Chu and his clients were both found to be co-conspirators in committing the fraudulent transfer, so I don't think his client could sue him.
If we approve of the rule that you're arguing for, would that mean that in every transaction, if a lawyer opposite a particular party is put on notice or it's suggested that something might not be quite accurate, whether it's in a partnership on the other side of the table across from the lawyer or spouses, that the lawyer then has to take action to protect the parties on the other side of the table?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe
what
that.
What if it were a partnership? Would you argue, what if this were a partnership, not spouses, no spousal relationship involved? Would you make the same argument that Chu had a duty to go get a power of attorney to protect a partner?
No, I would
limit
not.
Limit your rule and keep it from applying in a partnership context.
Under the facts that you've given me, Your Honor, no, I don't think I would. In this case, the difference is, in this case, Mr. Chu knew of Ms. Hong's interest and did everything he could do to do away with it and not notify her. In the partnership interest case that you're talking about, there's no evidence of that knowledge.
Well, let's assume there was. Same question.
Your Honor, if the facts show that the lawyer actively engaged in intent to deceive and defraud, yes, I think he would have liability. If the facts did not show that, I don't think he would.
Now you're adding facts. Just assume that the lawyer was on notice that something told to him by a partner in an entity opposite him might not be right or is incorrect. Does the lawyer then, in purely partnership context, have an obligation to do something to protect the partners of the party opposite his client in the transaction?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, under that set of facts.
How would you, in a principled fashion, limit the rule that you're arguing for in the spousal context so that it doesn't apply in a partnership context?
Well, I think the elements of fraud take care of that. And the elements of fraud and fraudulent transfer require knowledge and intent. And I didn't hear anything that would show knowledge and intent on the part of the lawyer in the partnership situation that you were giving me. So I think that's the difference. Now,
Mr. Graham, the jury found lost profits of $190,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was, they were instructed to find the amount of profits lost by the wife as a result of the transaction complained of. What was the evidence supporting that award?
Your Honor, we had tax returns from the transferees. We had direct testimony on what the gross sales were, what the cost of goods were, what the other costs were.
Was this for the period of time that the Kims had possession of it, or?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
And as soon as she got it back, it wasn't for any period after that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it was just for the period of time that the Kims had possession that the trial court later restored to the wife.
Yes, Your Honor.
and is that a community loss? I mean, I guess if they were still married, so I wonder if that's a community injury that the community could claim some recovery of.
That, I believe, is a community injury, and Judge, the final decree awarded my client 100% of the business and the business loss.
Right. And then, and also, set aside the award of the value of the business, lost value of the business.
Yes, it did.
Because she got the business back.
Yes, sir.
But the Kims just got, according to the evidence, the Kims just got to keep the $190,000.
The Kims didn't get to keep the $190,000, Your Honor. That was awarded to my client.
I know, but there's been no recovery yet.
Oh, that's correct. Yes, Your Honor.
And on conversion, how did Mr. Chu convert any property? Was there any evidence that he got anything other than a fee?
No, Your Honor. There was no evidence that he got anything other than a fee. Now, he did represent the Kims throughout the litigation, and he, of course, was pointed out he did avoid any liability to the Kims as a result of that continued representation.
So you concede the conversion finding against Mr. Chu was unsupported?
I believe that the conversion finding would be supported through conspiracy theory.
Well, you didn't ask them if they conspired to convert. You just said that the following persons convert. And they said, Chu, yes. So there's no evidence of that.
No, other than his direct participation in assisting that finding.
And under the TEFTA, how is he a transferee?
He didn't receive the donut shop. He didn't receive proceeds from the sale. All he got was a lawyer's fee.
Yes, Judge, and there are several jurisdictions, including New York, where that is enough. In fact, one of the cases, Stoastic Decisions, Inc. versus DiDomenico out of the Second Circuit in New York, found that was enough for the attorney to have liability
as a transfer.
And then in Florida,
the Florida Supreme Court went the other way and said the fee is not enough. Where is the majority in the nation on this question?
Judge, I think the majority is all over the board. You have
cases
on both sides from a lot of jurisdictions. And I could not make a clear majority either way. There's, of course, a lot of jurisdictions have not ruled on this issue. My brief had a number of jurisdictions that ruled that way. And even in the same federal districts, same circuits, some of the trial courts ruled differently.
The fraudulent transfer law is ancient. It's been around here probably longer than Texas has been around. And the idea was always just to get the property back. So how does it apply, just in theory, why should it be applied to somebody who doesn't have the property? Shouldn't we be going after the person that got it, even if they're in Korea?
Yes, Your Honor, except that I believe that would be bad policy to limit it just to the transferee and eliminate somebody that directly participated in making that happen when that person knew exactly what was going on and who had interests. And that's Mr. Chu in this case. He knew.
So you think we should be encouraging people to go get the aiders and forget about the guy that's got the property?
I think, Your Honor.
Isn't that who we should be focusing on, the guy that took the money and ran?
I think the court should focus on both. Otherwise, what you're doing is letting anybody participate, help somebody else defraud somebody out of property with no liability.
Would you have a cause of action against Chu if he had done this pro bono?
Yes. He's still a lawyer. Well, I would as a conspirator, Your Honor. I don't think I would as a transferee.
How about if the bank that transferred the funds to Korea knew perfectly well that the now ex-wife was claiming the funds? They're liable to?
I don't know that the bank knew that the wife was claiming the funds.
Hypothetical case. That's not your case, but the next one will be if we go with you. And they're going to say the bank knew that she said this was her donut shop and they should not have transferred those funds to Korea. So they're going to be liable to.
I believe that comes down to whether they had actual knowledge of it or not.
Assume they did. Assume they knew. She had picked up the phone and told them the day before, don't touch that money. That's my money. And the banks can't touch it either. Or they have to pay.
I think there's some exposure.
So the more ordinary or common situation being where one of the spouses cleans out the bank account and takes off with the money. How would this affect that? You think the bank would be liable in that situation?
No, Your Honor, because in that situation, each spouse has a right, an absolute right, to take 100% of the proceeds out of the bank account.
But the banker knows that there is a divorce proceeding underway and dividing up the property, and one of the spouses comes in and says, I'm going to take all the money. The bank officer knows all this.
I don't think that bank would, under that circumstance, would have any liability unless the bank was aware of a court order that prevented that from happening. Because the agreement when the spouse has opened that account is that either one of them could withdraw 100% of the proceeds at any time for any reason.
Presume with me that Tufta would not apply in this situation. The argument's been made it doesn't apply for money damages for an aiding and abetting theory. And if it didn't, then what would your next argument be in terms of recovery? Would it be conspiracy to commit conversion?
Conspiracy to commit conversion, conspiracy for breach of fiduciary duty, which the jury also found in this case. I think those are the two other causes of action that the jury found.
Those would be the two alternatives, then, that would support the judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's a statement in the briefs that you elected recovery under the statute. Is that because of attorney fees? Or?
Yes, Your Honor. That and recovery of the actual donut shop business.
Right. The Court of Appeals didn't address the conversion count, did they?
No, Your Honor, because the Court of Appeals found on the initial cause on Tufta, they didn't consider
it. She elected the Tufta remedy.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what would her recovery be under a conversion count?
I believe her recovery would be the same.
Except for attorney's fees.
Except for the attorney's fees, yes, Your Honor.
Any further questions?
Counsel, any further argument?
Just in short, Mr. Justice Jefferson, that I believe that the better policy for this court to consider and for the state to follow is to allow third-party liability as found by the Court of Appeals in this case to punish, if you will, or to prevent the kind of thing that happened to my client in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Mr. Cram talked about the Stochastic decision from the Second Circuit, a case cited in his brief and our reply brief. In that case, evidence was overwhelming that the defendant acted directly for his own personal benefit. But the mention of that case causes me to inform the court that we're going to be sending the court very shortly a letter referring to three decisions that have been made just in the first 9.5 months of 2007 so far, all from federal district courts, construing the law of three different jurisdictions, Minnesota, Montana, and Arizona, all of which held that there is no transferee liability under a conspiracy theory. And one of those cases, Magden Asset Management, I'll give you the citation and the case in the letter, is a case involving the law firm of Paul Hastings, Janofsky, and Walker. The facts are remarkably similar, and it was decided a few months ago.
A question. We ask respondent quite a few questions about the lawyer's duty in this case, but I don't read your brief to argue that issue. Is that correct, or do you also argue that the lawyer did not have a duty in this case to get a power of attorney in to investigate the facts and so on?
Just a sec, we certainly do argue that. We didn't frame it in terms of duty because we weren't dealing with a negligence cause of action. The sole basis, of course, for this judgment is statutory. It's Tufta. And so we framed it in terms of those elements, transferee, beneficiary types of damages. The discussion in this case, I think, shows, I don't need to tell the court what the benefits of oral argument, but I think it does show the benefit of it. Because to me, the bottom line for this case is, and this also is pointed out in the amicus brief, is we have an adversary system. An adversary system isn't limited to the courtroom. It certainly starts there. Perhaps all of us have had the situation of sitting on a bench in a courtroom with our adversary a few feet away, waiting for the case to be called, hoping it will be quickly called before he hears about the case decided last week by the 14th Court of Appeals, or before he finds out about that the witness sitting back here to the murder case knows things favoring the state, that but they haven't learned it because they haven't interviewed them.
Let's get away from the lawyer-client duty.
Right.
What if Chu was the brother-in-law or father-in-law, as in Schluter, and had actively aided and participated in a conversion of property? Let's put Tufta out of there as well. And knew that he was engaged in a conversion, maliciously engaged in the conversion. Let's say even profited from the conversion, and that didn't happen in this case, but let's say they split the value of the property and he took part of it and went one way and the ex-spouse went the other. Why wouldn't we have a cause of action for conversion independent from the just and right division of the marital property?
I believe that the case of Lykover grants relief. This is a case cited and discussed in both briefs, the Lykover case in the first court, grants relief against the lawyer in a situation like that. But he was right in there pitching all the way, Justice O'Neill.
But then that would be an evidentiary review, and you wouldn't be arguing then that liability would be precluded.
I believe you're right. But the facts would be, as you stated, he was in there pitching all the way and furthermore succeeded in getting a piece of the proceeds.
And that's a difference here, because he received fruits of whatever his labors were to conspire in defrauding.
That's not
the case here, is that correct?
It is not the case here, but I was, of course, responding to the hypothetical. And Mr. Lykover was in there orchestrating the fraud, doing the best he could to bring it about. He wasn't sitting in his office when suddenly a gentleman walks in and says, all right, I'm here to take the deal we didn't do 2 months ago.
Well, and just to follow up, if the Tufta cause of action doesn't stand, then what would be the disposition? Would it be remand to the Court of Appeals to review the conversion finding? Would it be a sufficiency review of the conversion finding? What would be the result if you prevail on your Tufta claim?
I think this court has the authority under Boyce Ironworks to take get those issues and decide them. If it does, I would suggest that it follow Schluter and Coors v. Scott and say that there's no basis for liability on those either. I realize that's a powerful issue.
Well, Schluter doesn't cover the third party.
That's right. Coors v. Scott, I believe, does. But I believe this court has the authority to reach those issues. Whether it were to reach them or remand them would be its discretion.
And you would agree that if we then said Schluter doesn't prevent, or there's no public policy reason to preclude a third party claim for someone who actively participated in a conversion, then you'd go to a sufficiency review?
I think you would do that. To reach that point, I think you would have to hurdle the barrier of Coors v. Scott.
Mr. Cohen, your client was found by the jury to have done a number of things that are bothersome. Conversion, conspiracy to breach fiduciary duty, and other things. We certainly don't want to be seen at this court as countenancing or encouraging such conduct. I know you're here not on the ethics or the morals of the conduct, but on the legality. But what do you say about the argument from the other side that some bad things happened here? There ought to be a remedy.
The bad things that happened here, Judge, were that, let's talk about the evidence, was that a lawyer was sitting in his office representing his client when the other side came in and said, we're here to do what your client wants us to do, which is sell him the business. And he got him to say, sure, he would have been better off and protected both himself and his client if he had gotten a power of attorney or demanded that Mrs. Hong appear. But he did get a written statement that he had Mr. Hong sign. I'm calling the husband Mr. Hong. His name is actually Kim, of course, but I don't want to confuse him. He did have him sign a sworn statement that said, an acknowledged statement in front of a notary that said, I have full power to do this. This was a adversary in his office saying, I'm here today to do this deal. Would he be there tomorrow? How long would he stay? He tried to cover it the best he could. I don't see the moral culpability that so angered the jury, the trial court, and obviously the majority in this case I know that this court probably spends half its time, maybe more, trying to figure out why do lawyers, judges, and juries act as they do. In this case, you don't have to wonder. You can read the first paragraph of the Fort Worth court's opinion. They're furious. Even the dissent was not pleased with Mr. Chu. But I challenge you to read this record and see what he did that was so horrible, because the pages I was telling you about before, Volume 5 at 115 to 127 and 135, the ones pages they selected, you won't find it there. In this case, he was the last man standing. The husband had fled with the money to Korea. The buyers took bankruptcy. There's a notice of bankruptcy in the record. Mr. Chu was there to suffer for whatever wrongs the husband did. The jury knew they couldn't get to those other parties.
Justice Johnson, did you have a question? Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
Thank you.
All rise. Did I tell him to sit at the wrong table? Yep. Oh, well. Worked out okay. Melissa Devine, nice to meet you.